Welcome to Leap On Apocalypse, episode 13, Bronco Apaches. I'm Brandon Seal. The young Leap On woke up with a sharp pain in his gut. Chivato, as his Mexican and Comanche friends called him, looked down at a blood-caked compress of herbs packed into a wound in his stomach. He was laying face up in a ravine, the sun overhead. He started to cry out for his little brother, Dinero, but something stopped him. He remembered that his brother was okay. They'd accidentally left him behind after a fight with a band of Kickapoos who had ambushed them near Musquis, Coahuila, but Chivato had come back for him. It was, in his later memory, quote, almost suicide, end quote, and it's why he had the bullet hole in him now. But he'd returned alone to the site where the Kickapoos had ambushed Chivato's little Lipan band, dismounted, and he'd begun slinking through the brush in search of his brother. Through sheer luck, or perhaps some subconscious brotherly bond, he found Dinero hiding in an improvised foxhole, loosely covered with brush. But the Kickapoos were still nearby, and they must have heard the sounds of Chivato and Dinero's emotional reunion. They turned toward the brush and started firing. Chivato told Dinero to make a run for his horse. Dinero made it and rode away, just as Chivato caught a round in his stomach. But Chivato knew how to heal. He'd seen it all before in a dream. He'd always known what he would do in this moment. He stuffed the wound with healing herbs from a leather pouch and said a prayer. And then the darkness came to him. But now he was awake again, and he saw the Kickapoo that shot him nearby, standing over him almost, but turned away, facing the sun, praying. The Kickapoo was going to finish him off, Chivato realized. He felt around for a weapon, but found nothing, not even the knife that Lipanes always carried on their hips. Then he remembered the derringer, concealed by rawhide against his forearm. He popped it forward, cocked the hammer, and crept to within point-blank range of the praying Kickapoo's head. He pulled the trigger, and the Kickapoo was dead before he hit the ground. Chivato had been born around 1852 to the Mexican Lipanes, the so-called Big Water Band, who lived along the southern bank of the Rio Grande, to which they may have helped give its name. Chivato and his people had lived in this region around Zaragoza, Coahuila, and El Remolino, here in the Peyote Hills, for more than a century now. But recently, it had become quite crowded with Native American refugees. Cherokee, Potawatomi, Kickapoo, Seminole, and Black Seminoles. And of course, Mescalero and Lipan Apaches, like those of Ramon and Juan Castro, and of a younger captain of the San Antonio Lipanes named Magosh. Chivato and his brother had been orphaned a few years prior by Mexican soldiers, maybe at the Gracias a Dios massacre in 1856, though the suggestion is that they were a bit older when it occurred. Just as the ending of the American Civil War in 1865 had brought the full brunt of the U.S. military to bear on the American Plains Indians, the ending of the French intervention in Mexico in 1867 had left a highly trained Mexican army with the bandwidth and firepower to eliminate any holdout Indios Bárbaros. Smoke signals across the Serranía del Burro in northern Coahuila warned of the Mexican military patrols scouring even the deepest, driest arroyos now. And Mexican friends in town began warning the Lipanes of pressure from above to cut them off. And soon, even the historically friendly storekeepers of Zaragoza, Coahuila, stopped selling them ammunition. There was talk of going into an American reservation in New Mexico, a reservation for the Mescalero Apaches, but at which apparently the Lipanes were welcome. Starting in 1873, just after the El Remolino massacre, I believe, this young Captain Magosh began coming and going to the Mescalero Reservation, along with many of his 350 followers. Perhaps that's where Chivato and Magosh first met. When Chivato first saw Magosh, he thought he'd been scalped. But he was just bald, though this made him a genetic anomaly amongst Native Americans who don't tend to suffer from male pattern baldness. It's hard not to want to attribute Magosh's hair loss to the stress that he had endured as the leader of the most persecuted people in Texas. In the grand Apache tradition, however, Magosh was the consummate alliance maker, and he had encouraged his Lipanes to accept at least a partial accommodation with U.S. reservation life. Yes, it would restrain their movement some. They would have to get a pass from the nearest base commander to even go off and hunt buffalo on lands that they'd been hunting on for centuries. But to be honest, even the buffalo weren't what they used to be. Between 1872 and 1874, the U.S. Army had virtually eliminated them from the southern plains. But accepting the Mescalero Reservation as a base would at least give Lipanes an outlet on the U.S. side of the Rio Grande when things got hot in Mexico, Magosh argued. And frankly, it would let them coordinate with their Mescalero cousins, marriages, religious ceremonies, and, yes, the occasional secret raid. And indeed, in the years following the El Remolino massacre, the region saw a, quote, perfect reign of terror for hundreds of miles, end quote, as renegade Lipanes, Mescaleros, and even some reservation-hopping Comanches collaborated to defend these old Apache homelands. Still, hundreds, if not thousands, of Lipanes refused to come into the reservations, and eventually the U.S. Army deployed 4,000 soldiers to West Texas to deal with them. Led by hardened buffalo soldiers and guided by bilingual Black Seminoles, these specialized Army units pursued the Lipanes relentlessly back and forth across the U.S.-Mexico border, which in practice no longer served as a guarantee of Lipan safety. In 1876, 20 Black Seminoles and 20 buffalo soldiers crossed the Rio Grande and attacked a Lipan community near Zaragoza, killing 14. In June of 1877, another combined Black Seminole and buffalo soldier force tracked a Lipan party 200 miles just to recover 23 horses. And then, a few weeks later, a mixed U.S. force surprised the Lipanes in a mountain camp outside of Zaragoza, killing 19 men, capturing large numbers of women, and making off with 125 horses. The victorious American officer, predictably, declared that it, quote, nearly wipes out the Lipans, end quote. In defiance of these proclamations, however, the Lipan whirlwind kept touching down behind the line of white settlement back in Texas. 10 Lipan men and one woman were found camping in Menard County in 1875. They were caught and killed, all of them, but other raids were more successful. In April 1878, a Lipan party crossed their first railroad tracks to raid 360 miles worth of ranches above Laredo, well behind the line of U.S. Army forces, well, I should add, leaving 18 people dead. In April of 1881, they hit a settlement 7 miles above Lakey, Texas, killing 4. Nearly 50 settlers were killed and 1,000 livestock stolen in the region of Fort Davis over a 2-year period, all or nearly all attributable to Apaches. Down in Mexico, army columns in Coahuila were still being ambushed by sizable Lipan forces in the Serranía del Burro. And even though the Black Seminoles trailed the Lipanes with particular doggedness, the Lipanes knew every watering hole between the Red River and the Rio Grande. They always remained one step ahead, sometimes spending as much time covering their tracks as making them, filling water holes with brush or dead animals to slow down their pursuers and other tricks. The U.S. Army began to suspect, correctly, that the Mescalero Reservation was serving as a safe haven for many of these Lipan renegades. And so in 1880, they entered the reservation to disarm and dismount all of the men there. 700 U.S. troops slipped onto the reservation on April 16, 1880, and corralled 250 Mescalero and Lipan men in a pen with manure, quote, 3 to 5 inches deep, end quote, and left them there for 5 days. During that time, the soldiers took 199 horses and at least as many guns from the Apaches' diminished stocks, never to be replaced or reimbursed. But eventually, Magosh and his Lipanes organized a jailbreak. When they busted out of the corrals, the soldiers opened fire on them, killing 10, but 25 in total, including Magosh himself, escaped. Around 1875, Chivato also started showing up on the Mescalero Reservation. And so too do the first reports of the peyote ceremony. Chivato's grandfather may have been a Lipan named Pedro Chivato, an old Lipan captain who some legends held was among the first Lipan to have learned the peyote ceremony from the earlier inhabitants of northern Coahuila and brought it into the Lipan world. Over the years, the Lipanes had adapted the ceremony and made it their own. They dispensed with some of the more wilder elements that earlier Spanish chroniclers had observed in favor of drumming and singing and more subdued beer dances and offerings to Grandfather Fire and other rituals that we can actually trace back 5,000 years through the rock art of the surrounding Lower Pecos River region. The Lipan ceremony remained an all-night affair, but was performed now inside a lodge instead of out in the open, built around the sacred Apache fours. Four structural cross members to the lodge, four petitioners at a time, entering and cycling just like the first Apaches who had emerged from the Guadalupe Mountains out onto the plains and scattered to the four cardinal directions. And we can actually trace some of the changes in Lipan religious expression through the words of Western chroniclers who wrote about them. Something about the experience of the previous centuries had caused them to move away from the belief in a sun god or some of the other deities that older accounts record them worshiping. In 1853, a Lipan captain told Sam Houston, quote, "I believe that the white man's god is a very rich god, and he gives the white man everything he wants. But the Indian's god is a very poor god, and he has nothing to give us, and the Indians have got nothing," end quote. Later in 1891, two other Lipanes were asked in Mexico if they had gods. They said no. When they were asked where they go when they die, they responded, quote, "To nowhere. We go to the soil. Death and nothing are the same word, tasa," end quote. To the extent that they still worshiped a god, it was a much more amorphous being. Quote, "There is only one god, and we worship him under the name in our tongue. He speaks to the Apache, but he speaks to any who have faith and ask. You white eyes no longer have sufficient faith to hear him. Long ago, he talked to some of you. Your book says that he did. If you really believe in him, he would do so now," end quote. And yet in general, it seems like they had moved away from the worship of a god and instead focused their religious expression on accessing the transcendent. The psychedelic aspect of peyote was there simply to facilitate this. It was really the ceremony itself that gave the participant access to the supernatural. The drumming, the singing, the community of it all. There was, according to legend, no other ceremony so powerful as the Lipan peyote ceremony. It erases the presence of the participant, allowing him or her to disappear in plain sight, to use my friend Gary Perez's phrase. There was nothing else like it, and even as I talk about it now, you can see how it might appeal to a modern audience, right? Like part of, again, what makes me feel that in studying the Lipanes, we might not be looking so much at the past as we are looking into the future. Lipanes themselves frankly believed that, quote, "supernatural power was naturally bestowed upon the Lipanes," end quote. You can see why other people found them arrogant or haughty. But when Chivato was a boy, he had gone on a 4-day vision quest into the mountains and been given a gift by a mountain lion. It was the gift of premonition. He could predict the outcomes of battles. This was quite a useful skill, as you might imagine, and it won him some renown in Lipan, Mescalero, and Comanche circles, including with the most famous Comanche of his day. Not long after he had helped lead the Comanches onto their reservation in 1875, Comanche Captain Quanah Parker visited the Mescalero Reservation and witnessed the peyote ceremony for the first time. And he was converted. Here was a new power for a new moment. He had to have more of it to bring it back to his people in Oklahoma, and he invited Chivato and a few other Lipan peyote singers, as they were called then, to return to Oklahoma with him. Quanah had an ulterior motive as well. Quanah needed bodyguards. His accommodationist policies had brought on the ire of many of the more traditional Comanches. Chivato and the other Lipan roadmen, as we'd call them today, brought both the Lipanes' fearsome reputation and their sacred ceremony with them when they started traveling to the Comanche reservation in the early 1880s. The peyote ceremony became the most powerful and enduring tool of Lipan diplomacy, and Lipan peyote singers or roadmen scattered like apostles in the last years of the 19th century to various Native American reservations. Instead of surrendering their sovereignty and entering a reservation of their own, they would project their power through and across the reservation system itself. In addition to the Mescalero Reservation, some Lipanes ended up with the Kiowa Apache next door to the Comanches in Oklahoma starting around 1874. Others came onto the reservation of their old Tonkawa allies in 1885, including the Lipan Army scout Johnson, who had tracked the Comanches to their final defeat. Some were even able to call on old trading relationships with Choctaws, who had sat on the other side of the checker square from their East Texas Caddoan rivals, and they settled as far east as the so-called Choctaw Apache Reservation in Louisiana. And many, like Chivato, settled with their old Comanche rivals on the Comanche Reservation. Chivato and his peyote singers would become the first roadmen of the new Native American church, relocating permanently, in fact, to the Comanche Reservation in 1887 to continue spreading the medicine amongst the North American Indians in Indian Territory. Today, more than 50 known North American tribes, all the way up into Canada, sit with the medicine as a part of their religious practice. The Lipanes peyote ceremony has become a unifying part of the modern Native American experience on this continent. Of course, these Lipan apostles had their detractors. Generally in this series, I've toned down the extent to which the Lipanes neighbors, even their Native American neighbors, found them hard to deal with, frustratingly inscrutable at times. Even their Mescalero Apache cousins held them at a distance on their own reservation. This line is from an interview with a Mescalero in 2010. Quote, "Look, the Lipanes are witches, man. They have their ceremonies, and they always cause us problems. Since they arrived more than a century ago, there have been problems," end quote. And yet the Lipanes were also a shining beacon of continued anti-colonial resistance to all Native Americans struggling to survive during this period. During the Mexican Revolution of the 1910s, Chivato found himself on a train being robbed by revolutionary bandidos. But when the revolutionaries found out that Chivato was a Lipan, they gave him back his meager belongings. He was the original revolutionary, they said. And into the 1880s, Mogosh and his people were still fighting. After their escape from the roundup on the Mescalero Reservation in 1880, they hid out for 5 years in the Guadalupe Mountains, that mythical birthplace of the Apache peoples. The U.S. Army eventually bought them off with the offer of a pardon and the promise to feed their families if Mogosh and his people would help them track down Geronimo. Mogosh, in turn, recruited several other Lipanes, including Chivato, who accompanied the 1886 Army expedition that brought Geronimo in. In a sense, the U.S. Army had given Geronimo both barrels: Mogosh, the warrior alliance maker, and Chivato, the apostle of the peyote ceremony. Whatever it was, it worked. But after Geronimo's surrender, Mogosh didn't just settle down. He resumed his old Lipan migratory cycles, summers in the mountains of New Mexico, winters in their old Coahuilan heartland, where hundreds of Lipanes still lived free. In 1891, two Lipan captains, buckskin fringe and all, managed to make their way to Mexico City to meet with Mexican President Porfirio Diaz and try to negotiate for the protection of their lands in and around Zaragoza, Coahuila. President Diaz offered some vague promises of friendship, but in 1896, the U.S. and Mexico were still signing agreements allowing their troops to cross the border to track down any remaining free Apaches, Apaches Broncos, as they called them in Spanish. Mexican forces were, in fact, still capturing and selling Apaches to area ranchers in an uncomfortable echo of old Spanish slaving practices. And indeed, there are ranches in Coahuila today still staffed by the descendants of these Apache captives, and who are, in fact, still prized for their uncanny ability with horses. In 1903, Mexican forces evicted 37 Lipanes from a canyon near Zaragoza, Coahuila. Fearing the worst, when Mogosh heard about it, he quickly arranged for them to be transported to the Mescalero Reservation in New Mexico, though this would be a year-long ordeal that would see these 37 Lipanes transported in cattle cars, detained in shadeless corrals, and fed raw, unshucked corn for months at a time. And yet we know that there were still other Lipanes out there, harried and harassed, but still living free. A larger Lipan settlement or settlements in the Santa Rosa Mountains was written about around this time, but considered too large to round up. And many Lipanes began to cycle back to Texas during these years, this time to stay. Unsurprisingly, since you now know the history of the Lipanes who defined themselves by their symbiotic relationship with the surrounding settler societies, these Texas Lipanes principally settled in enclave communities within the urban centers in their old ranges, in McAllen, just outside Laredo, in Ojinaga Presidio, where a Lipan cemetery still stands, and even in the middle of San Antonio. San Antonio's Alasan Apache Courts public housing project in the 1930s was built over a neighborhood known as Indian Town because of the concentration of Native Americans living in their old jacales on this old Lipan campsite as late as 1937. The last confirmed killing of an Apache on U.S. soil was 1907. But the last confirmed killing of free Bronco Apaches in Mexico, 2 men and 8 women, wasn't until 1935. And they had to use the Mexican Air Force to track them down. For context, this was 60 years after the Comanches surrendered, 50 years after Geronimo's last ride, 45 years after Wounded Knee, 20 years after Magosh, who had witnessed the Battle of the Alamo as a child, died at the age of 84, and 4 years after Chivato died on the Comanche reservation amongst 100 or so Lipanes that he had invited to come live with him on the land grant that he had secured by enrolling himself as a Comanche. It's wild to me that Bronco Apaches were still fighting into the aviation age. And I'll also point out that this killing came 10 years after José Vasconcelos was publishing The Virtues of the, quote, Raza Cósmica, end quote, and Diego Rivera was finishing his History of Mexico mural in the halls of Chapultepec. Pointed out because even in a post-revolutionary Mexico that celebrated the nation's indigenous roots, Apaches were still considered a special and an especially intolerable case. We'll never know when the last uncounted free Apache died, because they probably still haven't. There are communities today in the mountains of northern Coahuila that identify, cautiously and quietly, as Lipan Apaches, as reported by the research of Jose Medina Gonzalez Davila. They're not wearing buckskin fringe or plucking their eyebrows or coating their bodies with caliche dust. But there aren't too many folks walking around in conquistador helmets or powdered wigs in our cities either. Other tribes, particularly in the United States, had only extermination or the reservation to choose from. But in the end, the Apaches carved out their own space on the checkerboard and held it. I'm talking about the U.S.-Mexico border, a direct artifact of Apache power, and the Texas-Mexico border in particular. It's still the place where most Americans, and most Mexicans too, feel least comfortable. And there are today Lipanes and other Apaches living free throughout all of it. On the next and final episode of Lipan Apocalypse. Thank you for listening. Editing for this episode was performed by Susana Canseco. The intro and outro music is from the White Mountain Apache Crown Dancers. You can find them on YouTube. Special thanks this season to my Lipan friends, Bernard Barcena, Lucille Contreras, Richard Gonzalez, Margot Moreno, and Gary Perez. I hope I'm doing your story justice. And make sure to check out Lucille's Texas Tribal Buffalo Project online and fill out her Texas Indigenous Data Sovereignty Study. For more information about the Lipan Apaches, check out the books by Thomas Britton, Jose Medina Gonzalez Davila, Nancy McGowan Minor, and Sherry Robinson. Also, check out the doctoral thesis of Enrique Maestas and the Texas Observer article by Dylan Bedour. Lastly, go to Gorka Alonso's website, apacheria.es. For more information on my other projects, you can go to brandonseal.com.